This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The federal government adopted an estimated $2.2 trillion coronavirus relief package late last week. It includes expanded unemployment insurance, tax rebates and loans for small businesses, and additional support for the medical response. It also suspends federal foreclosures, evictions, some student loan issues, and offers some corporate relief, including for airlines. Let's talk about it. Joining Cincinnati Edition on the phone is Republican Congressman from Ohio's 8th District, Warren Davidson. Representative Davidson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you. Nice talking with you today.
It's our pleasure to have you. Thank you for making the time. I want to start with a letter that you signed on to, along with both Ohio U.S. senators and the entire congressional delegation from the Buckeye State. It's urging President Trump to act swiftly on a request from Governor Mike DeWine to approve a major disaster declaration for the state of Ohio in response to this ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. Can you let us know what the status of that request is?
Well, I think, we're waiting for an answer from the federal government, but at some point it's a bit of a formality. I don't think there's anyone questioning whether it's a disaster. The whole congressional delegation's on it, but technically the declaration needs to be made, and of course that frees up additional authorities and funds, largely through FEMA.
What funds exactly does that help us with?
Pardon me?
I'm just hopeful that you can help us understand a little bit some of the technical aspects of that, like what FEMA funds would be more readily available to the state if this declaration were offered up.
Well, so, I don't want to get the impression that somehow the state of Ohio hasn't already had support from the federal level. I think the governor's been clear that he's had good dialogue with the president and the administration. So when you look at what's happening with the National Guard activation, for example, in the state, when you look at, very high vis in New York City, Andrew Cuomo is the governor of New York, is frankly getting more press coverage than the president is. And the New York City setting up of field hospitals, federal flows of respirators, and you see them kind of the tip of the spear in terms of surge capacity. So thankfully, Ohio doesn't yet have the problem that New York City has, and we hope that we don't have that scale of problem. But when you start saying, hey, we need to prioritize, and because Ohio's system, should they become overwhelmed the way New York's systems have become overwhelmed, then it gives the additional support from the federal level to come in and meet that surge. And ideally, you want to do this in advance, which is what we're working on here in Ohio, so that everything's already in place and you're not reacting to something that's already upon you. So that's the goal of it.
Representative Davidson, Congress passed a $2.2 trillion estimated coronavirus relief package. There are a lot of details in this thing, a very expensive package. But from your perspective, what does this do for us?
Well, so I think, most people realize that the market didn't close the economy. Frankly, the governments at various levels chose to close the economy in response to this, intense public health crisis. And so you've had businesses that have effectively been told to close, and frankly, people that are prohibited from going to businesses. And that's, everything from elective procedures that are medical, that are costing hospitals, millions of dollars a month in terms of how do they stay open and profitable. Well, they need to do that so that they can meet the health crisis here. So you've got to get the funds to the hospitals so they stay solvent. You go down to individuals, and then historic numbers of individuals unemployed at the fastest rate ever, frankly. And so people that have lost their jobs, you want ideally as many of them as possible to be back on payrolls and have money flow to them and their business stay solvent and then keep their job and their benefits because they're going to be in a better position to help with the recovery on the back end and frankly have more stability overall for the economy. Nevertheless, some are going to be dislocated, and so you have a historic increase in the level of benefit in unemployment and, frankly, the number of people that are qualified. So 1099 employees, self-employed people, they're still rolling out the rules because historically those folks haven't been eligible for unemployment in Ohio anyway. So big expansions at that level. And then I think the part that's probably most misunderstood by people is this fund that Treasury is going to manage. And a big part of that is, for businesses bigger than 500 employees, which most hospitals are part of that. Hospitals have their own separate funding. but they're under the same sort of cash flow problems. In some cases, even worse. So airlines most acutely. I mean, I flew out to D.C. for the vote this last week, and there were three people on the plane going out to D.C. Two of us were members of Congress, three paying customers. So you can imagine how eerie an airport would feel with that little bit of traffic. So that is direct assistance, but the bulk of that fund is really to kickstart lending. So all of the plan assumes massive levels of borrowing, and so on the back end there has to be lending. And if the private sector can't accommodate that lending, then a lot of that's going to wind up on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, i.e. printing money, which isn't really good for everyone in the long run. So the key is to find that balance to kickstart the rest of the economy from something that the free market didn't produce. The government said closed it. And so at some level, the government has a responsibility to deal with the cost of that.
We're talking with Ohio Congressman Warren Davidson. And as you mentioned, this was a quite a price tag on this piece of legislation. Are you concerned at all about the longer that this pandemic persists and the longer that these individuals are unemployed or underemployed and all of these industries are directly impacted, that you're going to have to get together and adopt similar legislation down the road?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that there'll be a need for something beyond this. And, you know, one is you want to deal with it in a way that is, meets the criteria that I talked about before, but you also want to deal with it in a way that doesn't structurally create barriers to the economy growing, going back to work when it's possible and safe to do so. And I think that's where we need to have a clear plan on what is unwinding this look like. I think everyone's coming to grips with the fact that this isn't just going to be a deep V that, hey, we go down for a week or two or a month or two and then everybody goes back to work. It's going to be an unwinding of, okay, well, who goes back to work? What's the criteria? And even if you say, well, hey, you know, Easter, everybody goes back to work, everyone won't go back to work because everyone's not going to feel safe. And so just creating it in law isn't the thing. So how do you get the public, what's the new path for everybody to start feeling engaged in the economy? And so the phase four really needs to take into account how do we bridge that in a way that maybe restores the fundamentals of our economy that have really created, you know, lots of economic opportunity to the point where, you know, we're the land of opportunity. Not just for all Americans, but so many people around the world want to be here because more so than most anywhere else in the world, America provides hope and opportunity.
In just a moment, we're going to hear from Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley, who did take issue with one part of this bill. And we'll also hear from Dr. Amy Acton from here in Ohio about some projections about possible infections. But to continue on the legislation that came out of Congress, are you happy with the bill that was adopted?
Well, I don't think anyone's truly happy. I mean, they're not happy with the present situation. If you wrote the bill, there'd be 535 different variations of it. My bill would look very different than this bill. But fundamentally, I agree that the principle of directionally, if you think about it, the U.S. economy is about $1.8 trillion a month. So when you turn that off, you're going to have to bridge that in some way to make people whole for that decision. So it's maybe not the same as eminent domain. I mean, it's not permanently gone, but it's temporarily. The government's effectively deprived people and businesses of their livelihoods, in this case for good reason. But the bridge is spending and ideally some lending that helps bridge that. That's not just totally federal spending. So that part I agree with, and it's shameful, in my opinion, that you had structural pieces that were at odds with that narrow purpose. And I think the other piece is when you look at structurally, you don't want to fundamentally make it so whether it's people who own hedge funds or, you know, unemployed people, I don't think anyone should make money out of this situation in the sense that the bill that we passed ends up being a transfer that made people somehow better off than they were before this happened. It's ideally the goal of the named fund is the Economic Stabilization Fund. We want to create as much stability, even though it's somewhat arbitrary, for as many people as we can so that we get the economy back to normal as soon as we can.
Representative Davis, Representative Davidson. Can you talk a little bit for those of us who aren't members of Congress about how the work went inside that building, inside the Capitol, to garner as much bipartisan support that this ultimately ended up with, despite some of the back and forth that happened in the days preceding it?
Well, so the first piece is, should we do anything? I mean, some people say, well, the free market should rule. And that filters out pretty quickly. There are a handful of people in that camp that say, well, you know, people should have saved. And most everybody says, well, yeah, for normal things, this isn't normal. You're not supposed to save for the government closing the whole economy. So the government inherently has a responsibility. So I think overwhelmingly, in a bipartisan way, people agreed that the government had a responsibility to do that. And then when you look at policy solutions, I think we're still dealing with some inherent conflict in it. So on the one hand, you had people that said, well, if we just defer all these payments for 90, 120 days, 6 months, whatever, then everyone can have a better path to ride through it. So let's say your mortgage is deferred for 90 days. Well, but then on the other hand, we're going to bridge the economy by putting as much cash in the system as possible. Well, then do you still not pay your rent or your mortgage or anything? Because we just put the cash back in so that everybody can continue to function normally. So there's a little bit of incompatibility, and I think settling some of that out in phase four will happen, and make it a little more coherent. But you had people that really fundamentally pitched in and making it work. So I spent a lot of time trying to push for some mechanisms that promote good behavior in the lending, because you want the loans to small businesses to go out swiftly. Historically, the Small Business Administration has been a little slow, and this money needs to go out to keep people solvent. And then the other part is, you want enough customer relationship there, and that'll come out in the rulemaking piece when Treasury rolls it out. So when businesses are dealing with their current lenders, you know, their local bank or whatever, then that's an easier path than when you have people. You don't want people just setting up a company to make these loans all of a sudden with no relationship, just a website and everything else. That's going to be ripe for fraud. So how do we safeguard the businesses, the individuals, and frankly the government taxpayers that are on the hook for a lot of these loans? And I think the last piece is, that haven't received, again, as much attention, this $425 out of the $500 billion fund that the Treasury had, we needed some accountability for that. That got a lot of attention, but why is it? It's not a grant. It's not gifts from the government to businesses. It is a government guarantee so that the people that have collateral can actually lend. So we had a county in our district that was trying to go to the market with municipal bonds to basically fund the county government. And there was no buyer for that debt, i.e. no lender. So, you can't have borrowing without lending. And so this backstop actually is designed to get that market functioning again. In the intermediate time frame, the Fed is literally buying municipal bond issuances. So the Federal Reserve is doing that. So normal market forces aren't there. And so we spent a lot of time trying to get that balance out there. So I think that's one of the easiest to misunderstand components of the bill.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking with U.S. Congressman Warren Davidson, a Republican who represents the 8th Congressional District. Congressman, your district is just north of Cincinnati. A good portion of your district makes up part of the Cincinnati metro area. I want to play a little bit of reaction from Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley about this federal legislation.
There's also direct support for police and fire and ambulance workers in the bill, and healthcare workers like our public health department and our police department. However, at the moment, it appears that it will only go to cities and urban areas of 500,000 people or more. And though our region is 2 million, none of our jurisdictions exceed 500,000. And I think it would be deeply unfair for us as a region not to get our fair share. And so what we are asking Congress to do is, for any amount of money they give to cities to pay for ambulance workers, healthcare workers, police and fire, that it be done on a per capita basis, on a fair basis throughout the country. And so if you could help us lobby on that point as well. I can tell you that Senators Brown and Portman, Shabbat, Congressman Shabbat and Winstrup all personally committed that they would advocate for that point, and we are very thankful for that.
Congressman Davidson, that was Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley, who's making the point that some of these funds are designated for cities with a population of 500,000 or more. The city of Cincinnati proper, its population is below that threshold. But of course, the metro area has over 2 million people in it. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on his concern about that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the areas of the bill that a lot of people early on misunderstood. I think that that's becoming more clear to people. Fundamentally, they created a direct path for cities that are larger, that they got there. That frankly, the federal government arbitrarily set the number on a pro rata basis on the size of the city. And that was so that cities would not have to go work with their state legislatures. So to me, that really is a principle that I wouldn't have agreed upon, is that the federal government should be sending money straight to cities. I mean, the federal government exists because states created a federal government. The states have a path. Cincinnati usually does very well with the state legislature. So the federal government giving the money to the states and the states allocating that. And most people around the state would feel confident that Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland are going to do fine. And then the concern I deal with a lot is, are the rural areas of the district of the state going to do as well as some of our big cities? But when you look at the hospital capacity, I think that's the more rational basis. So when you look at the demand, I think state legislatures will do a good job of taking into account where that is. And at the federal level, one of the things that's arguable is, you know, when you have proportional distribution by state, by population, is that really the best way to allocate these funds? Because some areas, clearly early on anyway, New York City is having a much bigger problem than, you know, the state of Wyoming so far, right? So as an example, putting it on a pure per capita basis might not be the best allocation of the funds, but to the mayor's concern, I think the state legislature will be able to deal with that with all the cities. The reality is there was a carve-out that said, let's be clear, cities with this population get this much per, and it takes it out of the state's discretion.
Congressman Davidson, you talked just now about the hospital capacity and all that. We heard from, well, as we do every day, Dr. Amy Atkin, who appears with Governor DeWine during each daily briefing to update the state of Ohio on the current situation. She said something a few days ago that I'd like to play for you now and then get reaction.
Again, healthcare workers, very important, trying to keep them healthy for the surge to come. And we still see that of our cases, 16% of those are people who are on the front lines. And everything we are doing is to protect them. Our modeling is now showing that at the peak of this curve, we're now projecting that we may have as many as 10,000 new cases a day. And that is the number. And as the governor just said, we've built up hospital capacity in this country. And I want to say to you, there is no healthcare system in the world that could take on this virus as it was built.
Congressman Davidson, what are your concerns as you hear those words from Dr. Atkin?
Well, I think, you know, you're going to see more cases go up as you see more testing go up, and testing is growing. The reality is about 10% of our tests, and this is not inherently different between Ohio and nationally, about 10% of our tests are resulting in positive tests. And frankly, of the people that develop coronavirus, COVID-19, it's about 1.74% prove fatal, which is a very high number compared to other diseases, which is, you know, driving a lot of the concern. But Ohio's numbers aren't inherently different than that. And I think that what is flattening the curve do, it hopefully increases that survivability, because when people get this, a significant portion need to have respirators. And by significant, I mean, you know, somewhere 5% maybe. You know, so you look at that number, if 5% need respirators and 1.7% die, a healthy number of people, a fair percentage of people who even with respirators don't survive that path. So it's a small part of the number of people that actually get it that need respirators. But then once you're on a respirator, your odds of surviving it are not great, frankly. And we're trying to drive that up by getting high-quality respirators and as early as possible getting it into it. And then, frankly, as early as possible in the treatment, trying to rapidly expedite, you know, whether that's antivirals that have had a lot of study. There's, probably four promising things around the world that are fast-tracking for research in terms of treatments early, and that also diminishes the number of people that need respirators. So I think that's what this is all about, is shifting that out. And, they've been aggressive in trying to do that. And as I say, you know, while we're talking a lot about the economy, the public health crisis is the immediate thing. And, people shouldn't diminish the significance of this. For people that get it, it can prove, very fatal. And that hasn't fully resonated with everyone. And I think the piece is you want to increase the survivability of it. And I'd say last thing is, just like any war, the enemy gets a vote. So this virus is going to do its thing, and we will defeat it. We just want to defeat it swiftly.
And Congressman, before I let you go, I want to ask you one last thing. We saw that the Olympics are postponed till next year. The Kentucky Derby, which is always the first Saturday in May, is now going to take place in September. I'm reading that college football programs are looking at the possibility of not kicking off in the fall, which suggests that there is concern that this drags on throughout the year. But more important to most people than those classic sporting activities is the election that takes place in November. And, you know, there's talk that maybe we should shift to mail-in voting across the nation. And I would like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think, more immediately, we've already decided at the Ohio level. I mean, Ohio, in a very unprecedented way, canceled an election. The primary election that was supposed to be on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, was canceled at about 10 o'clock at night. And so the new date is April 28th, and so people do need to do mail-in ballots if they want to participate in the primary season in Ohio. So there's an active election still underway in Ohio to determine the primary winners. So that'll determine who's on the ballot for a number of races in the fall. And then secondarily, whether you support a mail-in ballot system or not, I'm 100% opposed to the federal government deciding how everyone in America runs their elections. So I think that, states can decide that. States should fundamentally ensure that every one person, one vote, you have free and fair elections, that they're easily accessible. And I think that, one of the best things that you can do about that is provide, a good audit trail so that there's accountability. And I think the other person is, when you look at one person, one vote, the system, whether it's mail-in, electronic, in-person, should establish the identity of the person who's voting in a traceable way, so that we know the person is eligible to vote, and that that the person's vote that is counted is the person who voted.
Warren Davidson is a Republican congressman who represents Ohio's 8th District. Congressman, thank you so much for all the time you gave us today.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate your coverage.
And we'll talk again soon.